After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Krishnadas Pilgrim Heart Hour. In this podcast, Krishnadas shares his warm-hearted and down-to-earth path to the divine. If you are interested in supporting Krishnadas's podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/KD.
You mentioned this morning the yogi who attain nirvana by faith.
Yes.
I never heard that before. I mean,
Srinika, the wanderer.
A wanderer?
Yeah, it's called, that's what they call him.
The wanderer, really?
Srinika, the wanderer. I'm not sure why they say wanderer. Maybe it just means Shramana, you know? For some reason, in that particular translation, they call it Srinika. Srinika, S-H-E-R-E-N-I-K-A. The wanderer who realized transcendent wisdom through faith.
Wow.
And that was last night. And about how faith could be a path to wisdom. Faith could be a path to the experience of reality, that is. Hmm. Which then leads to salvation, in that reality is then experienced as completely blissful, embracing, nurturing, compassion. Mm. And it's an exceptional thing in the context of Prajnaparamita, because in that context, wisdom, which has a symbol of a sword with a flame tip that cuts through the knots of confusion and delusion and ignorance, there's the idea of sort of a critical, penetrating analysis of superficial reality, apparent reality, then sort of taking it apart piece by piece, sort of drilling down through it to discover the ground field state of the clear light of the void, the clear light of bliss. Mm. And you know, the claim is that Buddha and his followers and other great siddhas anticipated the discoveries that were announced by Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg in 1926 in Copenhagen, that reality has no indivisible particle and that reality dissolves under analysis. So that which defeated materialism in the West, but in the progress of modern science, but which modern science has been in denial about since 1926, almost 90 years now, because they feel too insecure with the idea that reality is illusory. The conventional reality is illusory. It doesn't mean it does not exist, but it's illusory. There's no capturing theory of it other than the negation of any misplaced absoluteness. So that, you know, that takes a lot of what they call vipassana and shamatha. Shamatha or samadhi is one-pointed concentration, and vipassana is this kind of critical seeing that looks to see the reality of whatever appears to it whatever you see, and then in examining the reality, as you go finer and finer, it comes apart, mm-hmm. and it dissolves. And so then you were mentioned earlier about the definition of faith. So when they, now one thing that it does not mean, because the Buddha was very warned a great deal about it, that blind faith,
right.
or faith that is against common sense or against reason, is to be avoided. And not only because, since it has no reason, it might be faith in the wrong thing, mm-hmm. but also because it's weak. You know, if you have faith that there's going to be dinner in the Lhasa Inn because you had it yesterday, you have a reason to believe to go to Lhasa Inn, and you have like a motive. If you believe there's dinner in the half a mile this direction in the woods, you have no experience. There's no reason for you to think that.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a mistake to hike off through the woods. You might get lost and eaten by a bear.
Well, that was dinner. That's for somebody else.
So one thing faith is not necessarily is an anti-reason thing. Mm. But on the other hand, reality, then this was in the critical way of approach, the sort of wisdom way of approach, which is the more usual way in that tradition, there's this thing where reason takes you to the brink, but doesn't capture the experience. And actually, the experience is beyond some sort of reason formulaic thing. And and therefore, they sometimes say it's known by the method of not knowing. And then people get wrongly into thinking by understanding that. Nowadays, there are some people who misunderstand that by thinking that as long as they don't know anything, they're in life.
That's my category.
Buddha disappointed them when he attained enlightenment. He didn't sit under the tree and go, duh. That was a big disappointment for them.
Mm.
So in other words, that's where the opening of the faith comes in, because the faith is like somebody, in a way, they would argue that in previous life, that such a person, the Shrenika, the wanderer, mm-hmm. had investigated his world.
Uh-huh.
In previous lives, when he was a him or a her or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And so he had a strong intuition that it must be good, that, you know, that, right, like, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Rama, you know. The idea there is Rama, Krishna, they are more grounded in reality and therefore more powerful than Ravana or whatever the different, you know, Kamsa, you know, the king who was killing the babies, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea that goodness is more powerful than evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's reasonable if one investigates experience in a certain way and doesn't listen to propaganda, because evil always propagandizes itself that it is powerful and frightens people, and then it claims it's going to help them. Mm-hmm. And whereas good doesn't need to do that, but if one analyzes one's experience and the experience of the world and history and everything, good is actually clearly more powerful. For example, if evil was more powerful in the modern world, we would already be in nuclear winter, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
We would not actually be sitting in Menlo, it would be a nuclear slag heap. It's only 100 miles from New York City.
Mm.
And so that's a reasonable faith. So Shrenika had the, when he heard about non-duality, when he heard about this is really nirvana, and it's unreally not nirvana, but it's still something, and then there's a way of moving from one to the other. And he was wandering, looking. He was seeker. He was looking for truth, reality. He was looking at himself for his own reality, his own experience. And he didn't have a lot of sort of analytic equipment. He didn't read Nagarjuna and have the, you know, Madhyamaka and so on. But he clung with one-pointed faith to discarding any appearance of something being real that was not pure goodness.
Uh-huh. Right.
And he eventually Because why the critical thing is necessary normally is that we consciously can immediately understand, of course, you know, there couldn't be an absolute outside the world that was relevant to any relative being in the world, because then that relative being in the world couldn't get outside into an absolute, because absolute would be disconnected from the relative. So it would be irrelevant. We can easily understand that. We can easily understand that we are a relational process. Easily.
Yeah.
Because absolute means the opposite of relative.
Right.
It's just relative, absolute. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's senseless to say that. But we can easily understand that. But the unconscious is frightened to be completely immersed in relativity. Because then it has an idea that it won't know what happened. It has an idea there'll be a control if I can just have a grounding in something absolute. Mm-hmm. But of course, if you're grounded in it, it's relative. If you can stand on it, it's relative.
Mm-hmm.
So they have that fame, you know, what is the ground? The ground is groundlessness. Mm-hmm. You know, emptiness is the groundless ground, you know, in other words. Mm-hmm. So the faith, so the bhakti already has the idea, the concept that Krishna is love, that Krishna is the power, is Vishnu, Rama.
Mm-hmm.
And Rama wins out over the evil. And so, and those are just stories, they know that, and then they have a bigger vision of Vishnu, you know, lying on the shesha, you know, and waking up, and it's an aeon, and sleeping, it's not, you know. So the idea of a benevolent, positive energy as the strong energy of the universe, they have that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So then faith, chanting, bringing up the emotion, and in the process, you know, coming up with an internal obstruction and fears and things, and trusting them outward and so forth, then they finally do reach an experience of that. And that's the same as the person who critically cuts through all kinds of false appearances and reasons, that in that sense.
So when you're, like someone, when I was, when I, in my life, when I, Maharaji is that place for me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, my idea, my practice is to essentially see myself through his eyes rather than my own eyes.
Mm, right.
And so I'm constantly giving up my negative view of myself, mm-hmm. limited view of myself, because mm-hmm. that's not how he saw me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that with him, and mm-hmm. I feel that, you know, with him whenever I can, mm-hmm. whenever it happens. So,
mm-hmm.
so that's analogous to the cutting through.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a beautiful quote. Oh shit! I didn't bring my phone.
That's all right.
It'll still be beautiful tomorrow.
Well, roughly, what is it?
Well, Ramana Maharshi's talking about the path of surrender.
Uh-huh.
And they say, you can't surrender and expect the Lord to do what you want him to do. You know, you know, that's not surrender.
Right.
You know? So you have to keep letting go of, you know, surrender is surrender.
Yeah.
It can't be called surrender if you're upset that you're not getting what you want.
Yes, or that what you're surrendering to is not what you thought. He used the word the Lord.
Well, he used some word. I'm not sure what word, but
well, maybe, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's not. We'll talk about the Buddha.
That the Lord is not as you imagine the Lord to be. The Lord is what the Lord is, which is something
the
beyond
Lord actually,
the imagination.
It is. Beyond it may thought, even
concepts.
Be yourself.
Yeah. It may.
Which you didn't, one didn't imagine.
Yeah.
You know? Or,
exactly.
Or at least.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, the other, no, Om, the Om, take Om.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Om is a combination of ah, ooh, mm. You know, that's the short ah, short ooh, and mm.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the ah is the body of all Buddhas.
Mm.
They were in the Buddhist understanding, Tantra, you know, esoteric understanding of Om, ah, is the body of all Buddhas, which is the same as body of all deities and everything. And all Buddhas, they feel they are you and me and everyone here right now. Because they're also in every moment of time. Mm-hmm. To them, the stream of time is just also illusory. Not a complete illusion, but illusory, like an illusion. And they couldn't be perfected beings having abandoned us.
Right.
So they only become such a being by realizing that they are us. And whatever we were in that present of theirs that we think of as a remote past present, and also in this future moment of ours, they're also here without having abandoned us. Mm-hmm. So the ah means that all bodies of all Buddhas are here, right here. The uh means the speech of all Buddhas are right here. Means the mind of all Buddhas are right here. So for the esoteric Buddhist, Om invokes the immediacy of the true reality of this, which is the Lord, if one wants to personify it, or mm-hmm. the clear light of the void, or whatever you want mm-hmm. to say, whatever, mm-hmm. call it, no word even emptiness yeah. is not even...
Frank.
Complete word.
Call it Frank.
Frank, right. But the key, the best thing though, to emptiness and such words are negational words.
Yeah.
And negational words are better because they're more into opening and surrendering. Mm-hmm. Because you never do see the non-elephant in this room. You never see the non-elephant. You know, well, you just don't find the elephant.
Yeah. It's also a question of temperament, what fits a person, you know,
yeah,
a particular
sure.
place. So.
Yes.
But when Maharaji said all one.
Yes.
That's the all the time, everywhere, you know. He didn't say I'm all one, it's all one. He didn't say we're all one.
Yes.
That's not what he said. He said yes. sub ek.
Yes.
All one.
Yes.
So... Yeah.
But, you know, all one contains double negation. It's a double negation. Because all means many things.
Uh-huh. Right.
And one is one thing.
Right.
So if it's all one, it was already all one when it was all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'd say something.
So he's not, in other words, the oneness doesn't destroy the manyness.
Exactly, right, exactly. It of course maintains not. That's a mistake people make right. all the time.
Don't we do what well, people do. And for the path of surrender, the realization of reality, emptiness, yeah. is the path of surrender, and which is why people have experiences, yogis, meditators, seekers, philosophers, they have experiences where everything disappears mm-hmm. and seems like what their notion of the word empty might mean,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. And then they think, I realize empty guru and I realize emptiness. So now I'm a holy being.
Yeah.
But that's really quite wrong because there's no way you can be your surrender.
Right.
When you surrender, you're not there anymore.
Exactly.
It becomes you.
Yeah,
right. You give yourself to it. So yeah. you never possess even the experience of it in a certain way.
You know,
do you follow me?
Absolutely. Yeah. I used to sit in front of Maharaji.
Mm-hmm.
Day after day.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was sitting there and I realized, I laughed out loud actually to myself because I realized I was waiting there. I was waiting for something to happen.
Uh-huh.
I was waiting to be liberated, free,
uh-huh.
nirvana. And but I laughed because my implied understanding of that was someplace I would not be. Somewhere else than here. And I laughed in that moment because I saw and felt very uh-huh. clearly that there was no place I would not be ever. I was here. I would always be here.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't something, there was nothing else out uh-huh. there. So, you know, and it was really a quite a moment for me. You know.
And what did he say or do? When you laughed?
No, I don't think he did anything. He just threw
he didn't
a banana.
Do anything?
Maybe he threw a banana at me. I don't know.
He must have smiled.
You know, one time he said,
yes.
He said, Dada, I could have been a real, Dada was his disciple. Dada means elder brother.
Yeah.
And when Maharaji first met this man and started calling him Dada,
uh-huh.
he wanted Maharaji's wife, he wanted Dada's wife
oh.
to call him Dada.
I see.
And she said, he's not my Dada, he's my husband. Maharaj said, if he's my Dada, he's your Dada. So from then on, she had to call her husband elder brother. You know, so anyway, one day he said, Dada, I could have been a really big saint. I could have been a really big saint, Dada, but I had one fault. What's that, Baba? He said, too much compassion. Too much compassion, he said.
Yeah.
Too much compassion. And you know,
did he elaborate?
What's that?
Did he elaborate?
No, he didn't do a lot of elaboration, ever.
So too much compassion made him not be a really big saint.
Big saint in the sense of being famous and wearing red robes, mm-hmm. orange robes and mm-hmm. having a big thing and driving in fancy cars and having, you know, a mm-hmm. lot of PR done everywhere. That kind of big saint. Famous,
right, right.
big, you know. Right. Well, you know, that those.
Right.
He used to sit in the road.
Right.
This is like, you know, he'd just walk and he'd sit down anywhere. It was all emptiness. There was no place that it wasn't perfectly fine to just be. He'd sit down on the road. He would sit down and shit. He would sit down anywhere. It made no difference to him.
Right.
Really. He didn't look for a clean place to sit down. He plotzed, to use a Yiddish term, which is really, there's no exact Sanskrit equivalent to that. Maybe in Tibetan there's one, but not
plots.
Sanskrit. Plots. I just, you know, where to plots? Where to just let it all, that's plotzing. Anyway, and only a mensch can do that, you know, not a shmendrik. Only a mensch can do that. Yeah, okay, we won't go there today. So, yeah, there were a lot of things like that. But his implication that there was so much caring and compassion for anyone and everything that came to him that he couldn't keep anything for himself, even to separate himself from people and be a great saint with people. And there was no one between him. There was no anybody running the show. Like in those days, if you were in the temple with Maharaja, uh-huh. he was sitting there, he was doing everything. You know, in fact, he'd say, when people come here, they should feel like they're going to their grandfather's house.
Uh-huh.
Everything is given. You want to cook your food? We'll give you pots and pans. What do you want to do? It's all fine. There was no like higher and lower and
uh-huh.
grandiosity. It was
That's
just
really great.
On the outside. But on the other hand, you would look at him and you would see the beauty and radiance of the whole universe shining, you know,
mm-hmm.
and your mind would you couldn't pull yourself away from that. You didn't want to turn your eyes for a second. He was always looking, especially the Westerners, you know, I mean the Indians too, but he would always look at the Westerners and go like this, hey, you know, see like this. He used to say about the Westerners, he used to tell the Indian people, he'd say, these people they only want God. We look at them like, what? What are you talking about? You know, we didn't even understand, you know. They only want God. You miserable shits want, you know, come here for everything, jobs, children, you want this fixed, because that's what a saint does in India.
Oh, to the Indians, he said.
The Indians, yeah. You know, a saint in India who has siddhis, who has powers, people come to them for everything. They're poor, you're sick, he says, here, take this, you know, here, eat, take some of these ashes. And, you know, one time a young couple came up from the plains. They took buses and trains and buses and finally got to the temple. And they said that they came to Maharaji and they said, you know, your devotee, my grandfather, is very, very ill. He's suffering terribly. You know, and Maharaji's here. Take this banana and feed it to him. Sub ti ko jaga. Everything will be all right. He always said that, by the way. No matter what would happen, it would be all right. So they go back, they carry this banana, you know, all the way by bus and by train, you know, and they give it to their grandfather and everything's going to be all right. He takes one bite, leaves the body. Sub ti ko jaga. Everything's all right, you know. He was holding on to something. He was suffering. He couldn't let go.
Yes.
Boom. That was what was supposed to happen. One time, Mr. Tiwari, who was a great yogi and very close disciples, they were up on the roof of the temple, I think, and Maharaji started dancing in ecstasy, dancing around. He said, oh, she's gone. And he was saying this old devotee of his, this old lady from the plains, had died. I mean, nobody told him, but he knew. He said, oh, she's gone, she's gone. And Tiwari starts saying, you butcher. He says his guru, he says to you, butcher.
Really?
She served you for 30 years, night and day. How can you be in ecstasy when she's done? And he looked at him and said, what? You want me to act like one of the puppets like you?
You want me to what?
One of the puppets. You want me to act like one of the puppets? You want me to pretend I'm one of the puppets like you?
Really?
Yeah.
That's really great.
Yeah.
But also she was probably very relieved to be out of the carcass that wasn't functioning well at her age.
Yeah.
People do die when they want to.
Yeah.
Actually, unless they ate some Monsanto beforehand or something, then that's a little quicker. But otherwise they die when they're tired of it.
Yeah. When they're ready.
And then their soul is released and they have a dance in their subtle body.
That's right. He was dancing with her.
That's
you know, it was to sit with somebody like that.
That's true.
Who knows the past and the future and everything that's happening in the present moment, even in your own miserable mind. It's just, after a while, you have to let go of your stuff because there's nowhere to hang it, you know. He didn't buy into... He knew your storyline, of course. He knew it perfectly. He knew everything you thought about yourself. But like you said before, a perfect being sees everything. He sees all that. He sees that you don't see it's perfect. Mm-hmm. And what else could they do but try to help you see its perfection? Mm-hmm. You know, the only reason these great beings stay here is out of compassion for us.
Absolutely.
They have no program, no agenda of their own. There's no one in there to have an agenda. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting story. One time, Ram Dass was completely pissed off, really angry. Maharaji used to drive him out of his mind. And he would get so furious, right? So one time he comes up to Maharaji and he sits down and he said, Maharaji, I want you to raise my kundalini. And he's like, I want you to raise my kundalini. And Maharaji says, I don't know anything about that. You know, you go see Muktananda. He can do that. He'll do that. Yeah, you go see him. And Ram Dass got angrier. He said, Baba, I want you to raise my kundalini. Oh, Sai Baba. Go see Sai Baba. He'll do that. He'll do that for you. And Ram Dass got angrier. He said, no, Maharaji, I want you to raise my kundalini. So Maharaji got up. He'd been sitting on the bench. He got up. He threw his blanket over his shoulder and he looked down at Ram Dass and he said, I only know two things, Ra and Ma, the two syllables of the name of Ram. And then he left Ram Dass sitting there, went into his room.
Really?
We attributed a personality to him. We attributed someone who wanted to help us. We attributed somebody with likes and dislikes. He liked this one, he didn't like this one, you know. But his reality was Rama. There was no one in there to do anything, to want anything, to have any preferences. It was only ek, Rama all the time. Only thing. That was what he was seeing. He had no, there's a word for it in Sanskrit. But he had no desires of his own, no preferences, no agenda, nothing he didn't need anything to make him happy. You know, he had already become everything. So you sit with a being like that and you just kind of, stuff starts to just fall off of you, your arms, your legs, everything falls off. Because you're running your stuff through emptiness, through a being that's only love and compassion and kindness. There's nothing else in there. Reality's in there. And you're sitting with that. And everything that being does reflects that to you all the time, no matter what you're doing. One time, you know, the big thing was to grab his hand when he got up to walk, right? Uh-huh. Somebody would, and he would hold your hand because he walked like a two-year-old, like bang, 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 like this. So one time I got his hand. Yes, and we're walking. So he walked. We walked to the back of the temple, and he's kind of looking at me and laughing. And hi, look at this guy. So we got to the back of the temple, and he let go of my hand, and he took a few steps. So I took a few steps, and he said something which I didn't understand in Hindi. And he took a few steps. So I took a few steps. Finally, he just went like this, and he knelt down and he peed. He just wanted a couple of feet. That's all, just a little space to pee. And I wasn't going to give it to him. And he realized that, so he just, okay. And he, it was a great moment. Talk about mind stopping. He pees. So.
I love that. Yeah. When Dzongkhapa, at the age of 41, attained perfect enlightenment, he said at some later moment that the reality of things was the opposite from what he had expected. Mm. And he had been an absolute top scholar and also a great yogi, had many supernormal experiences and so on. Since the age of like 4 or 3, when he automatically knew to be, he didn't have to learn to read and everything.
Wow.
And yet when he did have the final moment, final clarity, let's say, final surrender, he said it was opposite from what he expected.
Exactly, the opposite of what I expected, yeah.
Yeah, he said.
Yeah.
And then how do we understand that? Everybody has some, they don't really tackle it.
Yeah.
But I think it is like you discover that you are everybody else. You thought you'd have this thing all to yourself.
That's that, yeah. That's right.
You thought you'd have it all to yourself.
Yeah.
And it's everybody's. Then you become the servant of those who don't know that they have it.
Actually. The servant.
That's too much compassion.
Yeah, servant. That's, you know, that's Hanuman. That's what Hanuman is. Not only is, on one hand, is the destroyer of calamities and obstacles, remover of obstacles, but he serves that part of you to enter into.
Well, this is definitely a research project I'm going to embark on. And we need a Hanuman statue here, a good sculptor or a good source. Uh-huh. Here at Menla, we have Ganesha here, but we don't have Hanuman.
Wonderful.
We really need Hanuman.
Great.
But you know the thing about the Tibetan legend about how the origin of the Tibetans? Do you know that?
You tell. Tell.
So, well, first of all, in the Indian, actually, it's an Indian thing, in the Karandavyuha Sutra, ancient Indian sutra, where Avalokiteshvara is introduced, the Lord that looks down with loving concern at all beings, that is, you know, Avalokiteshvara, a Buddha, a Bodhisattva who is considered the emanation of the infinite compassion of infinite Buddhas. Mm. So that's the first thing. He emanates in any kind of form that beings need, either divine or human or animal or anything, even as an inanimate object if that's what they need. Mm. And there's their idea. And then the Tibetan legend is that he was in a lifetime of a monkey. Uh-huh. But they never tell you the name. So far, I didn't find the name in any text. But I haven't really looked because I didn't really connect it in my mind with Hanuman till lately. I think some earlier time we were talking, I did, but I didn't have time to follow up. And he was a monk monkey. He was a monkey who was a monk. Mm-hmm. And he was enacting his vow to his guru, who was Amitabha, the Buddha of the Western paradise, the Buddha of ruby-colored Buddha, and his vow to to save the Tibetans, who were very aggressive and wild and crazy, something like that. Mm-hmm. And he went and meditated. No, that's not yet his vow. Well, maybe it was, but there were no Tibetans, that's right. So he went to the mountain Himalaya and he was meditating, this monk. And then there was a rock ogress who lived in that mountain.
Uh-huh. A demoness.
A demoness. Like, uh-huh. And she fell in love with the Avalokiteshvara monk. So she tried everything in the book to seduce him.
That's a hell of a book.
And she failed. But she finally said to him that she was going to fling herself off the mountain.
She was going to fling herself
if he didn't marry her.
Ah.
So then he, the emanation of Avalokiteshvara, who was the monkey, he asked his own sort of origin form or something like the celestial bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. He said, look, I know I'm a monk and I have a monk's vow, but this very nice demoness is going to kill herself if I don't marry her. So may I please resign my monkhood? And so, of course, you know, whatever, sure, if you want to do that to help her. So then they from their union came the Tibetan people.
Uh-huh.
So they're the cross between a monkey, a compassionate bodhisattva monkey, and a demoness. And that gave birth to the Tibetans. Mm. So there could be in the future a kind of wonderful international like thing. If one could discover that Hanuman is a form of that compassion, you know?
Well, you know.
And his name might have been Hanuman.
Because Hanuman is actually a form of Shiva. Do you know that?
Yeah, but he's a form of Avalokiteshvara.
That's my point, exactly. There's 11 Rudras. There's 11 faces of Shiva. Hanuman, uh-huh. And the most powerful one is the 11th Rudra, which has the face of a monkey.
Really? Oh, cool.
And that's Shiva sent his energy down through the wind god into, who then impregnated Anjana, who was a Vanar, not actually a monkey, but it was a race of, they could mostly monkey form, but they could take any form. They were semi-divine.
Right.
So it was through Shiva's energy through the wind god that was Hanuman, is Hanuman.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that other thing you said about Gosip Muktananda?
Yeah.
I met Muktananda and Ram Dass in Pune time in 1971.
Uh-huh.
I think it was 71. And there was like some sort of puja or celebration somewhere or something. And Nina and I were there with the babies. And Ram Dass was complaining to us. He had such a headache. His headache had been aching for weeks.
Mm.
And he couldn't get rid of his headache. So I think he went to get his kundalini raised by someone. And then it ran into something in his head.
Yeah.
And he had a terrible headache. And he was kind of blaming, you could see he was kind of blaming Muktananda about it.
Yeah,
Muktananda looked a little cranky too. Two of them. It's very funny. I just thought of that.
Yeah.
Such a headache. He bitterly complained to some of his old friends from pre-Robert Baba Ram Dass days about the headache.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know any of the backstory, unfortunately.
Right. Well, actually, that must have happened before this last story. Because he was on tour with Muktananda when he came back to India. And then we went, I must have been there, actually.
In Pune at that time?
Because we came back, Maharaji
wasn't there.
No, but he sent us down because Ram Dass had promised Muktananda he would do a yatra with him around South India.
That wasn't in 71?
It was.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but the story about the raising Kundalini with Maharaji was later.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but...
So
but
it still
it was a little tongue-in-cheek, you know, you go see Muktananda, he'll do that. You go see Sai Baba. You know? And then Maharaj says, what do I know about that? All I know is Ram.
Well, he just said that. He knew perfectly well. Yeah. Rama.
Rama.
Ra is seed syllable of fire.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Ma is seed syllable of emptiness.
Mm.
One of them. Anyway. Fire and emptiness. But, you know, people, if they get their kundalini raised in the wrong time, I was once contacted by the Catholic Diocese of New York. And they asked me if I did exorcisms. And I said that I didn't, but that that I knew some lamas who had told stories like that might indicate they might be able to. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't say out for sure that they could, but the particular one. And so they begged me to go see a client of theirs who was a Jewish woman who had had her kundalini raised by a swami.
Mm.
Like, apparently not. Well, they didn't really have a full explanation, but she said she had a most terrible situation she was in.
Mm.
And then she had converted to Catholicism in order to get those exorcists, the church exorcists,
yeah,
to help her,
because
she was in such agony.
Mm.
Had been for years. So they gave me the address and they begged, and I said, okay, I'll try to take that. And I asked one lama, I won't mention who. And then we went down there in the west side in the 20s. Above Chelsea. And they went into this apartment, and this woman was in bedridden, and then some parents or uncles or aunts, somebody were taking care of her. And then she told this story that was very, very vivid about how this, she had lived in the Bronx at that time and met some swami, and then the swami had raised her kundalini, and then she had just gotten into total agony. And she lived in a state of constant vision of being somewhere in around some duni, you know, some fire place with a bunch of cities. And they were poking the fire. And every time they would poke the chimta into the fire, she would have more agony. And all this kind of thing. So then the lama said she should practice exchange of self and other.
Mm.
And she should practice using the pain to absorb the pains from all suffering beings. You know, like in like a bodhisattva practice like
mm-hmm.
that. And she became furious.
She what?
Furious. She became absolutely outraged.
Wow.
So it didn't really work.
Uh-huh.
She said, I have enough pain. You want me to take more pain? He went completely wacky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then he said, then we sort of excused it. Then he said, well, okay, I think you need it. What you really need is another kundalini wala, you know, a specialist, a swami mm-hmm. type, because that's how it started. So they would be able maybe to help you. And then we kind of fled, you know. So I think he was being kind to Ram Dass not to do that.
Yeah.
Rather than just didn't know. Yeah. I'm sure he did know.
You know, one guy came up from Muktananda's ashram, and there's no criticism of Muktananda. This guy was already on the edge. And by the time he got up to the hills where we were, he was out of his mind. And we were staying in town in Nainital. And right next to the hotel that we were staying was this old church. And they still had services on Sunday. So one Sunday, this guy takes all his clothes off and he walks over to the church and goes up on the pulpit and starts giving a speech.
And naked truth.
The naked truth. So then the next day he came, we all went to he put his clothes back on late eventually, and we went to the temple the next day, and he came in front of Maharaji. Maharaji just went. So from that day on, for about 2 weeks, he didn't speak, and every day, at the end of 2 weeks, he was perfectly reasonably normal. He wasn't normal in the first place, but came back to what he was before. Just.
I guess.
You know, that's the thing. Nothing ever happened around Maharaji. We heard stories from this Baba, that Baba, people jumping up and barking like dogs and flapping their wings like chickens and all that shit, you know? We would sit there and nothing like that ever happened. It was just only love.
You know? That's it.
Only love and only sweetness. And every once in a while, a bop on the head, you know? But. It was just something else altogether. Something else.
Keshavananda was a bit like that.
Yeah.
When he was younger, when he got a bit older, then it was people around him and so on. It was a little bit difficult. It wasn't quite the same. But he was, his presence was like him. It was enough to just be in his presence.
I'm sorry? Yeah, it was enough to feel his presence. Yeah, that's all. Yeah, that was all we wanted.
It's a field thing.
Yeah.
There are stories about the Buddha like that. My favorite is his first lay disciple was someone called Yashas, who was a merchant's son. He was a yuppie, a banker's son, Satyaputta. And he had been in the forest with his friends having a party with some call girls. And then he and his friends were drugged and rolled.
Ooh.
So their American Express cards had been taken and their jewels. And then it was Indian
Express cards.
Jewels and, jewels and crowns and rings and all the fancy things. And very wealthy. And so he was like hungover and he had been drugged and he was furious. And he was looking for the girls who had rolled him. And he was running through the woods. And he somehow came upon Buddha and his monks who were sitting at the foot of trees meditating. And so he asked Buddha, he said, "Did you see them girls running with a bunch of clothes and two jewels and this and that? I'm looking for them. They took my stuff." And then Buddha said to him, "Well, would you rather find the girls in your clothes and the jewels? Or would you prefer to attain nirvana?" So the guy says, "Oh, nirvana, of course." Sits down. And in 8 hours, he attained it.
Really?
Yeah. Well, he got a little teaching, Four Noble Truths.
A little teaching.
The reality. Yeah. A little bit of analysis. And then at some point, his parents, who were worried about him, looking for him, like in the evening, what happened to him, you know, type of thing, where's our Yashas? And they came. They heard he might have stopped with Buddha and people, and they came. And then Buddha knew that they would interrupt him in his attainment of nirvana. So he made him invisible temporarily where they couldn't see him. I mean, behind a blanket or something or whatever.
Yeah.
They say made him invisible. Uh-huh. And he actually had the ability to do that. And he might have done that. And so then he chatted nicely with the parents. And then for another extra hour or something, had the monks bring them tea and chatted with them. And then he did break through and he had a realization of the nature of reality. That's nirvana. The Yashas, at least some stage of it. And then he removed the invisibility thing. They said, "Oh, Yashas, there you are." You know? And they said, they rushed up to embrace Yashas. And Yashas was like, "Oh, mom and dad, nice. I'm so happy. And I just heard a short teaching from this wanderer here, the Buddha. And everything is perfect. I love you deeply. I think I'll stay with him, though. Be a monk." "Oh, that'd be good," they said.
Oh, wow.
They agreed right away.
Mm.
And they became big dhanapatis, you know, sponsors of the community.
Wow.
But it's a story that is utterly impossible, except that the presence field was so powerful that when one entered it, one had a different vision of oneself.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
And much preferable one, actually. Much more open one.
You know, there's a beautiful story about the Baal Shem Tov.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, the Baal Shem Tov was a Jewish mystic in the 1600s, I think. I'm not sure. He actually was the first Hasidic Jew. He started that. That's why they all dressed like that. That was the hot style in the 1600s in Poland. So, or the Ukraine, it was kind of around there. But he had, of course, he had recognized reality, and he wasn't ready to be public. So he and his wife moved out to the forest, and they ran a small inn just in the woods on the one of the traveling roads. And every day,
that was in Europe, wasn't it?
Yeah, Poland, Russia.
Yeah, right.
So every day he would go off in the morning into the woods, into the mountains, and do his practices. But if he was needed, his wife would just go, his name was Israel. She would just go out of the house and go, "Israel," and he would be there immediately. Like, you know, come from manifest miles away, just like this. So one day she called him because a rabbi had arrived at the inn. So he comes in and he was dressed like a rustic person a rough kind of person. And he comes in, he takes the rabbi's horses and he says, "So you'll stay with us for the Sabbath," which was like 4 days away. And the rabbi was on his way to a wedding on the Sabbath in another town. So he looks at the rabbi and he smiles at him. He says, "So you'll stay for the Sabbath?" And the rabbi was very proper, like a, you know. And he said, "No, I'm going to so-and-so place. I won't be here for the Sabbath." "Oh, okay." And he takes his horses and the rabbi goes in, has a meal, goes to sleep, gets up in the morning. The Baal Shem brings him his horses. He gets on his buggy and goes down the road. And he's riding, and he's going down the road, and he kind of gets all spaced out, and he opens his eyes, and he's back at the inn, and the Baal Shem's holding his horses. And he's totally confused, and the Baal Shem says, "Oh, come on, come inside and have your food." So he just, okay. He goes in, he eats, has his thing, goes to sleep. Happens every day for 3 days. On the fourth day, or whatever the last day was to be, as he's riding away, he begins to have a meltdown, a total nervous breakdown. And he looks around him. He's all of a sudden, all he sees is suffering.
Oh.
Everywhere, that all beings are lonely and separated from each other and by a huge chasm. Everybody's alone and they're all suffering and there's no connection and everywhere and all these beings are, and he's flipping out and he's yelling at God, "What is this? How could this be? And he hears a voice coming in this kind of huge space, just whispering words. And he sees that all the beings are relaxing and softening and they're attracted to this voice and they all coming together. And he opens his eyes and the Baal Shem Tov is holding his horses and smiling at him. And he realizes the voice he heard was the voice of the Baal Shem. And the idea is that all these beings, when we see ourselves through the eyes of love, through the guru's eyes, through the siddha's eyes, through the yogi's eyes, through the saint's eyes, we see the oneness in us. We see the love, and it brings us all together. We see ourselves through those eyes. This is what it is to be with a great lama, a great saint. And so that was the Baal Shem becoming into public, his first public thing. From that guy became his disciple, and from there on it went, you know. It's beautiful, beautiful stuff.
That's really great. It reminds me of this moment. I was just reading A Life of Rumi.
Mm-hmm.
And someone wrote, Brad Gooch, it's going to be soon published, it's a really good one. And when he first met Shamsi Tabriz, you know, who became his great guru and inspiration.
Yeah, sure. Shams.
The Shams, he rushed up and walked up to him in the street. He'd never met him. He was on a horse himself.
Yeah, he was in procession, actually, wasn't he? Rumi was with
he was with all his followers. He was always a great teacher, poet.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he was incredibly accomplished already.
Sure. Yeah.
Extraordinary. And he was going somewhere to do a teaching or something in Konya. He was on a horse. And then Shams came up and in a friendly way and greeted him and took a hold of the bridle of the horse to have a little chat with him or something. And then he asked him something about another Sufi who had a vision of Muhammad. And then, but somehow the thing about it was that, the question was, there were two other Sufis who had visions of Muhammad, and one of them then remained just a total devotee of Muhammad. And the other one started like giving sort of elaborated teachings based on the authority of his vision, I think was the difference. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm not totally clear to remember. I'm absolutely clear. And he asked Rumi which one did he think was more far out, you know, more appropriate, et cetera, something like that. And Rumi said, "You should stay with the vision of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing greater than that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rather than add your own something to it," something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow through that thing, then the two of them went off and spent like 6 months
just in conversation, locked up in a room together.
On top of a room, on top of a goldsmith who was a student of Rumi's, protected from all the followers and everybody. Yeah. And everybody was really pissed off and freaked out. And Rumi like completely changed his whole thing. But it had to do with this faith, actually.
Yeah.
Had to do with something with faith.
Yeah, very much, very much. He had to do with love, too.
Absolutely.
The love that he felt for Shams, and it just totally wiped out his mind. You know?
But they were seeing Muhammad also as love, as a figure of love, actually.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they were seeing him totally, not just as something, he was like channeling the love of God's love. You know, Rumi had that, right?
Yeah.
Rumi was, when Rumi's funeral came, I was very surprised. At his funeral, there were more Christians than Jews in the city, Greeks and Jews in the city.
Really?
Came out practically than his Muslim followers. And the Muslim followers didn't really realize how popular he was with the members of the other faiths.
Uh-huh.
And they were trying to chase them away, like monopolize and make it a Muslim affair. And it was not. It was an interfaith affair, you know?
Yeah.
So wonderful.
Yeah.
But the Baal Shem Tov, right? He sounds like, it reminds me of like some Siddha, Indian
Siddha. Absolutely. Yeah, there's an incredible book.
That's my thing about the Jewish people. They, the whole legend of Adam leaving Eden, I think they all came from India.
Uh-huh.
Not just from Ur, you know. What is Ur? Some like dusty town someplace in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
They came from India.
That's true.
And they were real Indian yogis, I think. Originally, and they sort of then they mixed that up Abraham and Adam and I don't know
Abraham. Abraham is Abram.
Brahm, yeah, B-R-H-M in both languages are vowel signs.
Brahm.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
actually, Abram. So it's not really a name. It's just like there's Abram, a Brahman.
No. So that's what I think. And the Tsar of David, Seal of Solomon, you know, is the Shiva Shakti.
Mm.
Symbol and the Vajra Yogini, you know, symbol. It's the heart chakra, actually.
Yeah.
Symbol of heart chakra. Sixfold knot around the central channel in the heart where the super subtle soul is kept. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's what they are.
That's a story of faith, too, you know.
They had a longer wandering.
Yeah. God said to Abraham.
What?
God said to Abraham.
Yes.
Kill me a son. Abe said, God, you must be putting me on. God said, Abe. Abe said, what? God said, Abe, you can do what you want to, but the next time you see me coming, man, you better run.
Really?
Abe said, God, where do you want this killing done? God said, way out on Highway 61.
That's the one. Yeah, that's right.
So, he's also Jewish, by the way.
That, you know, that story in the Abrahamic tradition is the parallel to the Vesantara story.
The which story?
Vesantara. Yeah, the Buddha's immediate previous life to being Siddhartha, you know, and Shakyamuni, is said to be he was Vesantara.
Uh-huh.
Vesa means Vaishya, you know, merchant class, you know.
Uh-huh.
But he was a king, he was the king's son. But in that life, he had this thing about generosity.
Uh-huh.
He's, you know, his vow was from when he could speak. Actually, when his mother was pregnant, they had her kind of keep her controlled because if she was out in town or anything, she would take off her clothes, her jewels, and she would just be giving everything to everybody. Yeah. She was like a channel of generosity when he was in the womb in that life. And then he himself, once he was born, he was always giving, and it was a very, very wealthy kingdom. And so they had four almshouses on the four gates of the city.
Mm.
And he would go, all he did, the prince, everybody loved him, of course.
Mm.
And all he did, he was really beautiful, blah, blah, blah. And all he did was go from gatehouse to gatehouse day after day and give away whatever anybody asked him for.
Mm.
And then his wife, Madri was her name.
Madri.
She was in love with him, of course. And he said, no, you don't want to marry me. And she said, why? He said, well, if anybody asks me for you, I will give you away. That's why. Or if we have children, I'll give them away. And she said, I don't care. I love you. You can do whatever, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, because in that society, you the man sort of owned the family, right?
Yeah. Sure.
So therefore could be asked to give it. So then one day some spies came from the neighboring kingdom and posing as needy Brahmins. And they asked him to give them the national defense elephant, a giant tusker, you know, that was like defeat anybody in any battle, you know, like huge giant thing, like the aircraft carrier, right. You know, of the town, you know. And he said, sure, you can have it here. You take it.
Oh.
And then the citizens rebelled and they asked that he be executed, and he was like a menace. They turned completely against him. And they said he was a menace. And the father didn't want to execute him, but he said, well, I have to do something to satisfy my subjects and my ministers, so I banish you to such and such a, you know, black mountain. And so he said, okay, I'll go over there. And then Madri and the two children, by that time, they wanted to go with him. And he said, no, no, don't come with me. I'll give you away. You know? And you don't want to come with me. Just stay in town here. And they said, no, no, we're going with you. You know? So then he sets out in proper princely fashion with chariot and horses and, you know, equipment and baggage, whatever. But he doesn't get too far. And he's given it all away. And they're walking on foot. Finally, they get to the mountain. And then in the mountain, all the animals stop hunting each other, and it creates like a paradise there, you know, because of this powerful generosity. And then the bad guy of the story is an old Brahmin who married a very young wife who has other appetites than him, and she wants to have, and she hears that he has two princely children. He's the guy off in the woods, and that he gives anything you ask. So she tells the husband, you go ask for those children. I want them as servants. So then the wife is out gathering nuts and berries and honey or whatever, and he's there with his kids, and this old Brahmin comes up. And the Brahmin says, I'm sorry, but I need your children to be my servants. And the children hear the conversation, and they run off, and they hide in a stream with a little straw like a snorkel. You know, they have this straw which they're breathing through, and they're invisible in the stream. But anyway, he goes and he catches them and he gives them away.
Whoa.
And then they're screaming, no, no, he's a goblin. He's going to cook us and eat us. No, daddy. Not something. And actually, he goes for his bow, you know, to shoot the old Brahmin, not to do his generosity vow. And then he puts it down. Remember, this is his life, his giving. So he actually gives them away to their uncertain fate. And then Madri comes back. Where's the kids? You know, well, I told you, you know, I gave them to the old Brahmin. She passes out. And then a little bit later, she's inconsolate, of course, and then disconsolate and inconsolable. And then Indra comes down as another creeped out Brahmin. And, you know, Chakra, Indra, what they call it. And he asked for her. And oh, great, here, you can have her. And then it's nothing, you know. But it's a terrible, and that story, you know, that for thousands of years they've been arguing, and they have a passion play about it, you know, in Buddhist societies. And they argue and they say, that's just those monks who are like making nasty about the family, you know, and giving away the kids, you know, that's horrible and terrible. Just like you have that about the Abraham thing. Why would he be willing to do that?
Right.
And he's almost has raised the knife to sacrifice his own son. And then God says, no, no, it's just a test, you know, right? And similarly in the Buddhist story, it ends well because the old Brahmin goes through the home city on the way, taking the kids back to the wife. And then the king recognizes his grandchildren, and then he buys them off the guy. And then everybody in the town feels guilty that they banished him, and they invite him back. It's a celebration, you know, at the end.
And this is...
And Indra was just Indra, so he doesn't, you know, he gives back the wife. You know? It's just a final test. He wanted to help him finish his vow. You know?
Of course. Yeah, he was totally selfless.
Huh?
He was totally selfless, Indra.
Indra could be very naughty.
He could be.
Could be, but usually not around the Buddha, actually.
Probably. He
tried to behave himself.
And that's the Buddha's previous...
Just before his enlightenment.
Just before his enlightenment.
So the generosity, transcendent generosity. I mean, he had many other lives of in the generosity category. One of the freakiest ones that my Sanskrit teacher so much hated, where he was the king of Shibi, was his name. And this blind person came and said, you know, I want your eyes. And so the king of Shibi said, oh, wonderful. Somebody asked me finally for something that is hard to give, and that's, wow, I really want to do that. So let's do it. And he calls the surgeons in, you know, and everybody's just weeping and screaming. No, the king can't be blind. You know, the country will be defenseless, blah, blah, blah. It was another previous life. Mm. And so he then says, no, no, no. And he brings the surgeons, and then he won't be anesthetized because he wants to make sure they don't make pretend to botch the job and then claim they couldn't do it or whatever it is. And he's there, and he's in ecstasy giving away the eyes. Terrible pain, you know, pulling out the optic nerve or whatever it was. And then they're implanted in the blind beggar, and everybody's still completely berserk. And then he does the act of truth, you know, satyagraha, the origin of the concept of satyagraha, the act of truth. And he says, look, what can I do to shut you people up? You don't realize I'm really happy that this challenge was put to me, and I rose to it. He said, I'm very, very, this is a great thing. I'm going to have like eagle's eyes. I'm going to have Buddha eyes very soon in another life. Mm-hmm. And then they were like that. So he said, look, if I'm telling the truth that this was a pleasure for me, I'm delighted about it, it's totally great, let my eyes be restored so you guys can calm down. And bang, he had them back. That's the act of truth. Mm-hmm. You know, which is in Indian history.
Mm-hmm.
It's sweet stories.
Yeah, it's a sweet story. All the Jataka tales.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're really amazing. There was another one where in a previous life, Buddha was Indra.
Acha.
And in that life, he was the Indra of that universe or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And he was making war, defending the city on top of Mount Meru and making war on the Asuras. Because
mm-hmm.
they were always trying to attack the city, you know, Sudarshana, yeah. the Indra city,
yeah.
Olympus sort of city.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's making war. And then the battle went against the Devas for once, temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
So he was retreating to regroup. And his charioteer was driving him down a narrow forest path. And, you know, those chariots have a high pole, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he saw that the pole was about to knock an eagle nest down, and there were eagle chicklings in the eagle nest.
Mm-hmm.
So he tells the charioteer, stop, stop. So what do you mean we're getting away from the Asuras are chasing us, the titans, you know. He says, yeah, I know, but can you get around it? No, I can't go in this direction. I can't get around it.
Mm.
Well, we can't go that way then. Go back. But Your Majesty, you're going right into the teeth of the army, of the Titan army. They're going to kill you. They're going to do something, blah, blah, blah. Never mind. Those eagles are not in this battle. I'm not going to make them collateral damage. He says, turn around. I have no business harming the eagle chicks there. So somehow they manhandle the chariot around, and they charge back that way. And again, when Asura see him coming, they think he's got the reinforcements already, and they all run away.
Yeah.
I love that one because it's this little tiny detail, you know.
Yeah.
Indian storytelling is so fantastic.
Yeah, right.
Okay. I think it's time, isn't it?
Yeah, it's time.
Is it time?
Yeah. Why don't we sing for a few minutes? Just
okay.
A few, and then, yeah.
Okay. Who's going to sing? Your folks are coming back?
They didn't go anywhere. Wake up.
I'm going to...
They're around. They're always around, lurking in the dark.
Oh, I'm sorry. There they are.